Turns out there's a lot of debate right now over whether it's okay to feel hopeful in the face of climate change. Science writer Emma Maris was one of the first to argue that to slow carbon emissions and get ready for the challenges ahead, we're going to need some hope. In her book, Rambunctious Garden, Maris writes that it's not just newspaper headlines and environmental campaigns that need to change. She says ecologists and conservationists also need to rethink just what nature is. Steve Paulson started out by asking Maris whether she thinks environmentalists are pessimistic.
Yes, I think they are. Many of them are. And I don't think that's necessarily a new phenomenon. I think a certain amount of pessimism and negative ideas about the future have been part of what it means to be an environmentalist for quite some time.
And do you share that pessimism?
Well, I do think that there are grave problems facing us, and I do think climate change is a scary thing, and I think it's very appropriate to be nervous and worried and to want to take action. But I also think that there are areas that we can be optimistic about, and I do think that there is some reframing that we can do so that the future doesn't seem like a guaranteed failure. If you think about nature out there as having certain qualities and properties, and if some of these properties that you feel it must have include that it look the way it did in the past, that it sort of be unchanged or historically accurate, then climate change means that it's very likely that we're going to lose that look and feel of a lot of places. And so if that change is unacceptable, if all change to natural systems is unacceptable, then we're basically guaranteeing that the future will be a grim place. But if we see those changes as possible positive adaptation, and if we look around and see these new landscapes as wild places and beautiful places, then there's a possibility that we'll have some good places in the future.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it, because most biologists, when you ask them about their potential scenarios for the future, I mean, they see a rather grim picture. I mean, you know, species going extinct, ecosystems getting wiped out.
In some ways, this reframing is my attempt to help forestall some of that. Now, species extinctions, that's a tragedy when a species goes extinct. As far as ecosystems being wiped out, I think that's where it gets kind of interesting. Because if an ecosystem changes, if new things come in from abroad or species move their ranges in response to climate change, does that constitute being wiped out or does that constitute just changing? I see kind of surprising and interesting wildness in some of these landscapes that ecologists have often dismissed as sort of being trashy because they are filled with non-native species.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. There are some places on, say, the Big Island of Hawaii where you walk into the forest and there's mango trees there and there's Asian sword ferns, Native Hawaiian plants as well, Australian ironwoods, and they're all kind of growing together in this diverse forest. You know, if you were an ecologist from Mars, you wouldn't necessarily know that these were all non-natives. You'd see a pretty beautiful jungle. But if you're a trained tropical ecologist, you tend to see this as a disaster.
So part of your project is to sort of break down this distinction of native species good, invasive species bad.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, there are non-native species species introductions that have been total tragedies. The brown tree snake in Guam wiped out a dozen forest birds forever, and that's horrible. But interestingly, if you look at the data, most species introductions don't become these kinds of disasters. And some of them, we are actually finding strange and interesting ways in which non-natives and natives can kind of form new mutualisms. There's the case of the endangered southwestern willow flycatcher, which is now nesting primarily in non-native shrubs. So it becomes more complicated. And as the climate changes, everything is going to move around, and nativeness is going to become a much squishier concept.
Now, there is a word that has come up where some of these debates get played out. It's the Anthropocene.
Right.
Tell us what the Anthropocene is.
Well, the Anthropocene is an interesting concept, and I think it's raised some hackles. It is fundamentally just a descriptive concept. It's saying, okay, in 2014, many of the sort of fundamental Earth processes are determined by humans. And, of course, climate change is in some ways the ultimate expression of that. So the Anthropocene is not an endorsement of this necessarily. Before we figure out where we're going to go and how we're going to cope, we need to know where we are. And where we are now is in the Anthropocene, the age of man.
Well, and then there's a huge debate about whether this is necessarily a disaster.
Yeah, I think that we have to be open to the possibility that there can be some positive outcomes here. I just think it's a terrible tragedy to say to our children, anytime humans touch nature, they ruin it. Humans have touched all nature, therefore all nature is ruined. Have fun with that. You know, I just think that's too miserable of a future to hand down to our children. We can still have wild places. We can still have incredible diversity. We can still protect species. We can move away from kind of mindlessly affecting the earth and start trying to be more conscious about the way we affect the earth. But we're not going to ever be able to go back to a world where humans are not one of the profound drivers.
But I guess the question then is, if we see that climate change is starting to profoundly affect certain habitats, should we try to engineer particular ecosystems to make them better, to make them so that they can survive?
I think that that's already happening. I mean, and sort of practicing conservation biologists and ecologists are using the term resilience a lot. You know, if you're managing a forest and you're trying to figure out what kind of fire regime to have, and you might look at climate forecasts and say, there are some dry, hot times coming. So instead of trying to manage this for one type of forest, we might let it transition over to another type of forest that can handle this sort of more frequent fires, for example.
What does that mean to let it transition over to? I mean, you're talking about actually planting different trees that are, you know, can handle fire better?
That would be pretty extreme to actually plant different trees. Much more often, it's the case of letting changes that are underway unfold on their own. So if you have new tree species moving into your area, your first impulse as a conservationist might be to say, let's rip them out. But maybe the reason they're showing up is because your climate is getting more amenable to that species. And in fact, they might need the space. They might be having trouble at the southern end of their range. So you might welcome those trees. You might let those trees start to grow and reproduce in your area, even though they weren't there historically.
Now, the response that you'll get from some ecologists is that, yes, humans have always affected nature. And yet, if humans start to try to engineer nature, I mean, that's the height of arrogance. I mean, that's folly.
So, yeah, at some level, I pretty much agree with that. And that's why I advocate sometimes not trying to freeze places in time and to actually let them change. So I think that what we're going to end up doing, I hope, is a real medley of levels of intervention.
I'm wondering if we should also consider our relationship with nature spiritually or aesthetically. Do we have to deal with that here?
Yeah, and I, to be honest, that's something that I have personally been very reluctant to deal with because I am a science journalist and I'm a science nerd. But you can't really avoid this question of values because ultimately when you decide to manage this way or that way, it's all because of what you want, and what you want depends on your value system.
Tell me about your own relationship then. I mean, your spiritual relationship with nature.
So one thing that this whole project has done for me is kind of give me my nature back. I mean, I grew up in Seattle and I had a very nature-loving childhood that involved a lot of scrubby city parks and kind of empty lots. And at a certain point, I got educated that this was not good enough nature, really. It wasn't the wilderness. It wasn't pristine. It wasn't old growth. I kind of checked out a little bit from nature for quite a while because I thought, well, if I'm not in a national park or if I'm not seeing like really big flashy animals, then it doesn't really count as nature. Since I've sort of started to take a kind of a broader view of what counts as nature, I've just sort of seen it all around me kind of explode. The diversity of the city and the diversity of second growth forests, there's stuff living there. So it's kind of enriched my world in a pretty profound way.
It's fascinating. I mean, you're kind of saying that you got your sense of hope back. Do you think if more people changed their notions of nature, their ideas of nature, it would actually generate more activism, more will to confront the realities of climate change?
Absolutely. Because if we tell ourselves as a culture this story that the only thing we can do is delay the ultimate day in which all wild places are sullied by climate change and by human touch, then we're asking people to sign up for this sort of hospice nursing project of sort of ushering nature to its grave. And that is not a compelling cause that people want to join. But if we say, We can protect species. We can increase the amount of land that's undeveloped. We can have these flourishing natures. Then we're asking people to join a cause that is optimistic, that is productive and proactive.
Emma Maris's book is called Rambunctious Garden: Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World.